Accession number 28358, reel 11.
Really 11 now.
Where do I start?
Right. Well, that must have been really something, that coronation
it was,
day. You know,
yes.
So far away.
It was. I should have mentioned homesickness, because that was something that I think affected everybody in Japan, in Korea. At times, you longed for the mail, the letters from home. And also you relied on home for sending things out, because things were difficult to get hold of sometimes.
Well, could you get parcels sent, you know?
Yes. My mother was very, very good. And she wrote frequently. And I said that, you know, we lacked newspapers. And she sent bundles of newspapers out and picture posts, which I used to hand on to the patients. And she was very good like that. My father sent me books that had been published. And they're very good. And when the comet came into a force, the Aerojet plane, the mail out to Japan and presumably Korea got out much more quickly. And we were getting air letters out in 4 days. Otherwise, they take 10 days, you see, even air letters to get out. Sea mail took 6 weeks. Parcel came. Sea mail took at least 6 weeks. But I remember my mother baked some shortbread and sent it out by airmail, and it was so crisp just out of her oven. I got it about 4 days later, and I couldn't believe it, because they hadn't anything like cakes in Japan or in Korea, and it was wonderful. And everybody relied on the mail. It was very, very important, and sometimes it was delayed, but it was nobody's fault, it just happened. But I think the troops, everybody at times. I met one lad from Sussex, I remember, and he was a bit homesick, and I said, well, I come from Sussex, and we had a talk, and, you know, it was just part of the course.
And I suppose, really, Jill, the culture was so different,
it
wasn't
was
it?
Incredible.
In both countries,
yes.
Japan and Korea.
Yes, yes, the culture, the sights, actually the smells, the climate, everything was so different, and and I used to feel like a giant because I was fairly tall, and Japanese are so small, you see. The whole thing, the food, but it had its compensations. There were beautiful hills behind us in Japan, and we could climb them, and perhaps swim occasionally in the sea and things like that. Korea, everything obviously is much more restricted. But I did have 24 hours even in Incheon. That's wonderful, just to get out for. But we were getting to the rainy season, and the humidity was 100%. It was terribly hot and sticky towards the end of my time in Korea. I was very tired towards the end of it.
I can imagine without running water as well.
Yes, you managed somehow. You had a bird bath and dinner out of your enamel bowl, and you had a shower whenever you could. I mean, that was it. But again, in both Japan and Korea, in the high summer, I was there for both, you sweated and sweated, and your grey dresses were soaked. In Japan particularly, I used to have to change it 3 times a day, especially if you're doing heavy nursing. And again, in Korea, the stuff is beginning to smell a bit mouldy through the humidity. We didn't have anything like fans or ice or anything in Korea, obviously. We did in Japan, but it was sort of...
Were you there for the actual armistice?
Yes, I was.
What was that like? What was the tension building up for that?
The peace talks have been going on and off and on and off. And one thing that happened to me... A few weeks before, this quartermaster major said to myself and a colleague, would you like to come up on the roof of the mess with me? It's something I want to show you. We weren't quite sure what this was, but it was well worth seeing. On the roof, he showed us the searchlights panning down on Panmunjom, where the peace talks were taking part. They were panning down like that. And it was miles away, but you could see it. It was a clear night. And we asked him about the peace talks. They were on and off. And there was a time when Syngman Rhee was the president of South Korea, was behaving badly. He released a lot of communist prisoners of war. I don't know why he did it, but it upset everybody. And everybody really wanted peace. And it seemed so senseless, everything that was going on all the time. And the people were still being blown up, people were still being wounded. There was a case soon after I got to Korea, that I think it was the Third Battle of the Hook, and some of our British boys are very badly buried in debris from being buried after bombing or something. It was still bits were going on all the time. And then for the last few days, I was going to return to Japan, but I was there at the time, and nobody really believed the peace talks would be signed. And then we heard they were going to be signed at whatever time it was the next day, on the 27th of July, and again, it felt like that. And they were signed. And I think people were relieved, but the reactions were muted, I think, as far as I could see. And that night, we were invited to a party at headquarters to mark the occasion, I suppose. And I think we probably had champagne, and some of the younger officers were jumping into, there was a small swimming pool there, so they were jumping in with their glasses of champagne. But everybody was very muted because we weren't sure whether it was going to last or what was going to happen. And that was the general reaction, I think, to it. It wasn't one of joyful. It had been such a messy war, you know, I think. And there'd been a lot of very brave people who'd been sort of messed about through it. But
you were saying that you felt in Britain that the mass of people weren't interested or didn't know much about it.
I'm sure that's absolutely right. I felt that, and I used to write home to my parents, if only people would really understand what was going on out here with these boys coming in with awful wounds, and they were young kids, and you know, to us it seemed so senseless. And I wrote several times about that, and I've spoken to people since, and I think it was because this war was so close to the end of the World War II, everybody was war weary, and apart from that, it was miles and miles away from everybody. Communications were very poor, and nobody really probably knew what was going on, except the people that were involved with it. So
how did you return from Korea then? Oh, this would be after the armistice.
Yes, it was. I think it was about the 31st of July. It was several days afterwards. I returned to Japan, to Kyoto. I flew back in the Dakota, and the way I'd come. And I arrived back, I must have left quite early, I arrived back in the mess of action in Kyoto about lunchtime, I think, or early afternoon. And I was very tired at the time, and we hadn't had much off duty because we couldn't really in Korea. And I was just longing to have a couple of days off, or leave, I was due some leave. And all my stuff was packed away, and I reported to Matron's office. We'd changed Matron's by then. And I'd also committed a misdemeanor by being overweight with my luggage when I went out and got ticked off, but I got over that, and it was all right. I blamed the scales. But, and I reported to the matron, and she didn't sort of know me particularly. And I said, I've just returned from Korea, ma'am. Oh, she said, yes. Well, she said, you can go on duty this afternoon or something, or tomorrow morning. I said, Mum, I couldn't say I was tired because, I mean, that wouldn't wash. But I said, I'm sorry, Mum, but my trunks are still packed. They were still packed everywhere, you see. I had to I have only dirty uniform. All right, well, you can take the day off and go on duty the next day. So I didn't even get a word out of leave. So I went back to the mess, and as soon as I got there, the floor shook, the windows rattled, and we had an earth tremor. So I thought, well, I know where I am. I'm back in Japan. But anyway, She was all right, really, because a few weeks later I had a rather severe dental abscess and had to have a tooth out when I was on night duty, and she was very kind to me then. And then my papers had come back to return to home establishment, because I was due to go home then, back to the UK. And she said, sent for me. She said, I've got a job for you, Miss Hall, before you go. I want to, we've just heard that the hospital ship, the Danish hospital ship, Jutlandia, is doing a round the world tour to take United Nations wounded, sick and wounded, home to their home countries. And we have 10 or a certain number of British sick and wounded to join this. And we would like you, with your experience, to take the hospital train right up to Tokyo and deliver these patients to the hospital ship. And after that, she said, I know you haven't had any leave. You can have 3 days leave, come back, and then it'll be time for you to return on the troop ship home, so you will have finished your duties here. And I was very sort of acting the hospital train, and I got it ready. Again, at this time I was given 2 orderlies. I had 10 patients with various wounds recovering from sickness to take with me. It was a very long journey up to Tokyo, then I had to go on to Yokohama, because it was an old-fashioned coal-burning train, and I think it took 18 hours to get up there. It was a long, long journey. I set up, or at least 12 hours, something. I set off at 12 midday with my train, hitched onto the leave train, with my 10 patients and my 2 very good REMC nursing orderlies and all the their luggage and the things we needed on board the train to look after the patients. And we arrived in Tokyo, I think it was 6 o'clock the next morning, or just after 6. The patients were wonderful, and I looked after their dressings, and we kept them amused and looked after them all those hours, and we took turns to have a cat nap on the train going up.
Would they have been prisoners of war?
They may have been. The prisoners, the second wave of prisoners, were being released then in August. I don't think these were. I don't remember that they were. But our shipping details were delayed by the release of obviously by the prisoners of war later. But anyway. And we got up to Yokohama. We were met by a Canadian Red Cross and given welcome mugs of hot coffee. And then we went by ambulance to the huge American hospital base in Tokyo. I was separated then by the patients who were taken to one ward, and I was taken off to have a meal and came back again. And then we were put in ambulance buses. And this was a real United Nations meeting. There were Turkish ex-patients there. I saw the Turks, very handsome, smartly dressed in their uniform, and they carried walking sticks. There were representatives of most of the different United Nations that had taken part in the war, sick and wounded from there. So we made up an enormous convoy at this American hospital, which took 3 hours in waiting in the ambulances to form. And we set off for the docks in Yokohama with outriders, with sirens and flashing lights, you name it, being led by the Americans. And we went off on this long drive. And I suddenly realised about half an hour, 20 minutes later, I'd passed that bit of the scenery before. And the Americans had lost the way to the docks with this enormous convoy of hundreds of sick and wounded going on to this hospital. It was real. I was killing myself. But anyway, we did a double turn and came back, and we eventually got to the docks in Yokohama and transported the patients onto this beautiful hospital ship. It was luxurious, painted in pale green, lovely. And I left my patients in wards with sort of swinging bunks, and they were happy and they were going home. And it was absolutely wonderful. And I went off to, I think there were 2 small bays, and I went off to thank my sister to say goodbye to her as I was leaving, and crashed into a naval officer. I think he was actually the captain. He was awfully, and I spoke very good English, and showed me around part of the ship. It was like a floating palace, and it was so lovely for those patients. And they were going to be transported all the way. That was the Jutlandia. Anyway.
What was the name of it?
Jutlandia. Jutlandia.
A Danish.
It was the only Danish hospital ship, and it was the one I'd seen in Busan when I'd been there originally. So the patients were fine, and I had a few days leave due to me, 2 or 3 days in Tokyo, which was wonderful. And I said goodbye to the RMC orders who were going back by train. They had a few hours in Tokyo, then thank you. And went to the leave camp, dumped my stuff, and I had saved some dollars in Korea, American dollars, and I'd been told the PX in Tokyo was a place to buy wonderful luxurious things, and I desperately needed some underwear because you couldn't buy anything like that. My mother had been sending me pants out, but I wanted an underslip and something lacy feminine to go home on the ship with. Went to this in uniform, to this American PX, found the store, found a beautiful lacy slip, and everything was Russian when I left home. Tried to buy it from the Japanese girl. She said, no, no. I said, but I have American dollars. I saved these in Korea. Anyway, she said, no. She got the manager. And he said, no, ma'am, you cannot buy anything in this store. And I let rip, I'm afraid. I said, I've just been to your American hospital. You've got convoy lost. I've taken the contingent to United Nations patients to the Danish hospital ship in the docks in Yokohama to go home. I said, I've just come back from Korea. I worked with the Americans, and you won't sell me this bloody suit. I really lost my temper, and I stormed out. And he called me back. He said, Mom, you can have the whole store if you want to. So, but I was livid because they used to buy our whiskey and our naffy. And when I was in Korea, you wanted to get a sanitary belt or something. It was very difficult. Mum, you couldn't get anything. I was trying to get something from the PX. They weren't too keen. It was so stupid. And I was in army uniform. Anyway, I let rip and I got my slip, and it was lovely. I never had such. I couldn't afford any more than that because they were very expensive.
So how did you get home from Japan?
Well, I returned to Kure, and there was a bit of a muddle because all the prisoners of war were being released, and they were taking up the berths on the ship. And I was going, and I wasn't going. It was happening to us all. And then eventually I had about 12 hours' notice, and I was sent with Pat, who had come out with me on the Dunera, and it was absolutely wonderful. Just to think,
what sort of ship was the Dunera? That's got quite a history, hasn't it?
It has, yes. It was belonged to the British India Steam Navigation Company, one of their many troop ships, and it had just had a refit. It was absolutely luxurious, and we were given a huge cabin, and it was so different from the trooper that we went out with. I wouldn't say it was a very happy ship, actually. It was extraordinary, and there were one or two odd things. I think we had a suicide on board going home, and one or two things, very sad things like that. Because my parents met me at Southampton Docks, which was absolutely wonderful. And my father said the first thing we saw coming off your ship was a coffin. I have a feeling it was, I don't know the history, but there was an informer or something, I don't know. It was, and we did have quite a thing I ought to tell you about, is the prisoners of war that had been released. Because when we were waiting in the docks to sail from Kure, we were delayed a bit, and we saw a raggle-taggle of soldiers coming with military police on board. And then another raggle-taggle of them. And apparently, these poor prisoners of war had been released. They had been given all the pay, gone down to Kure, to the beer halls and that, a lot of them, spent it, and were being brought on board drunk. It was so sad to see, after all they'd been through. I mean, it may have only been a few of them, but we saw quite a number coming on board like that. It was an awful mistake that somebody had made over that. So, anyway, we set sail from Kure, and 6 weeks later we were at home, and it was wonderful. And from there, I served again as a nursing sister, a more senior. I was promoted to captain later. I did a junior officer's course. And I'd been working on the wards as a senior sister, and at the junior officer's course, they asked me if I would do my training as a sister tutor. and I was selected to do this by the army, and I had to go out to University of Edinburgh and Royal College of Nursing in Edinburgh for an interview, and I was accepted. And then I did a one-year academic course. The tutor course was just 1 year then. It was the last one, 1 year in the country, to train as a nurse tutor at the university and the College of Nursing there. That was a very interesting and very intensive academic course. There are about 32 of us on the course, three nursing sisters from the army, two from the navy, nuns, representatives from World Health Organizations, people from all over the world, and several British. It was very stiff. In the first week, about five or six dropped out. But we managed, and we had three academic terms, studied eight subjects which were examined in and at the university. We also at the same time did a teacher training course of 1 year at Moray House Teaching College in Edinburgh, and a lot of other extra things we had to do, like the Harvard Business School, a quicker reading course and a few odds and ends like that, and qualified as a registered nurse tutor. And we had a graduation ceremony there in July the following year, 1956. And then I taught as a junior tutor at Millbank and at Aldershot before I eventually went to the Royal Victoria Hospital, Netley, which is a psychiatric training school. And the psychiatric hospital eventually became a joint forces hospital, and one of the first military hospitals that had been built, and built by Queen Victoria in beautiful grounds on Southampton Water. There I was asked to do the Army psychiatric nursing course of 6 months in practical and theory, and I had to sit an examination. And after that, I took over the whole of the School of Nursing as assistant tutor in charge, and I was training, had 100 students, RAMC, orderlies under training. The regulars trained up to state registered mental nurse, and some were national service, and they did their army training of nursing orderly class 3, class 2, class 1, and the finals. And at the same time, they had to pass their military exams and their educational exams. And it was a very busy school, and I was very lucky to have it, and I was in charge of the school there. And ran the school. We had a very progressive commanding officer who eventually became brigadier in charge of psychiatric medicine for the army, and he was very, very helpful with me running the school. He was keen to get on, do everything in the modern way. One time I was asked to be an examiner to one of the civilian schools outside. We worked in conjunction with them, and had a very busy but very happy 3 years there. And then eventually I was married to Clive in the Royal Chapel there, which was built by Queen Victoria in April, 15th of April 1961, which was a wonderful occasion. And the sisters from the mess removed all the carpets, the stair carpets, to the old chapel, because it was in the disused building of the old hospital, so my wedding dress wouldn't get soiled, which is that. And it's a beautiful chapel, it's the size of St Martin's in the Fields. And I had to resign my commission on my marriage because no QAs were allowed to.
How did you feel about that?
Well, at the time, I was 33 then. I'd known Clive a little on and off for 10 years. And I felt the time had come for me to leave, but I was very grateful. I loved my service in the QAs, and I must pay a tribute to the matrons who trained me in my civilian training, and particularly the ones in the QARNC. I learnt so much. The discipline was very tough, but it's what we needed at the time to cope with the conditions we were in, particularly in Korea. And the loyalty of the matrons. I remember my matron, Colonel Somerville, sending for me when I was at Cambridge and asking me, she's telling me she knew I lived in Hastings, and the QA retirement nurses' home was in Hastings, she said, would you please take this package to my old matron, Miss Davis, who is there? And we remained friends for a long time. And when I was in Korea, my mother used to go and visit her. And then Colonel Somerville, I used to visit in her old age. And it continues like that today, the loyalty of it all.
So I believe you belong to the Korean Veterans
Yes, I'm one of the few women, actually, that belong to that. And I'm one of a few. And I belong to the West Yorkshire branch at first because we were living in Yorkshire at the time. I was rather shy about doing it. I was the only woman member of this. And they actually asked me to be president eventually of that association, and they've given me a little cup for this. But I had to leave. I took it on, and they were sweet. And I had to leave fairly soon after because my husband retired and we moved to Cornwall. But I'm still a member of them and have been to many occasions, distinguished occasions, gatherings through this.
Do you still feel, and we've only got a couple of minutes yes. left now, do you still feel the Korean War is a forgotten war?
I do, and so do all the veterans. Most of the veterans I've met in Britain have stickers called the Forgotten War. And it was, and so many of them were national servicemen, because the national service was extended after that to 2 years, I think, when the Korean War broke out. And they were so, they gave up so much, and they were so good. And I'm still in contact with quite a few of them now, and I have the greatest respect and admiration for them. So.
Well, Jill McNair, thank you very much indeed for spending so long telling me about your most interesting experiences. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much. I'm glad it won't be forgotten. I meant that on the Koreans. I mean,
yes, well, it certainly won't be. You've put a wonderful record here, haven't you?
Well, I hope so. I feel it's very muddled, but...